Okay.
I always thought my history was the fact I was born at 736 Harlem Street in Youngstown, Ohio, a steel town. There were 11 families on the block, 7 blacks and 4 whites. I have pictures of some of them. And my sister and our neighbor used to dance to Brother Beans and Susie. And I couldn't figure out how they even knew about it as kids, you know. But I guess they knew it from Duke Ellington and so forth coming to Youngstown. But, and then my father could not read and write.
Where was he born?
In Epps, Alabama. My mother was born in Georgia. In fact, see my mother's picture up there behind me?
Yes.
That's my graduation day. But I always say that was her graduation day. Because she made it possible for me to go to Redshift. Yeah. And I'll never forget. In fact, she taught me something that was very important, that I may have to die to protect her honor. Because, you know, you go downtown, white boys say anything to your mother. You know? And I had about 250 guys I was going to kill when I grew up. But unfortunately, now, if I look at my list of people I should take off, a lot of them are Negroes. And then Roy Thomas, who's now a medical doctor, I haven't seen him again, told me about Morehouse.
You knew him in Youngstown?
Pardon?
You knew him in Youngstown. You knew him in Youngstown.
Oh, yeah. He lived right near me. And because I was on the honor roll when I graduated from high school. I was the first black in the history of the town to be elected as a member of a class officer, first class officer. And we organized...
What year was this?
1942. Yeah, I graduated January 42. And the poor people organized to make sure we controlled the officers. So we had an Italian girl, Frances DeTesco from Briar Hill. We had an Italian girl from my neighborhood, Mary Bandozzi, and you had Preston Wilcox. And my nickname was Cy, from the Weaver of Riverlow, the Silas Marner. So I always used to carry a book home from school, and that book I could fit into my pocket. And since I was on a football team, basketball team, guys would hide it and all kinds of stuff. So they started calling me Cy Wilcox. They still call me that. And I guess there was a neighbor in my block, Miss Harrion, who put a hand on my head one day when I was about 7 years of age and said, "You're going to make a great contribution to your people."
Beautiful.
And at first I look at it as a burden, man. I said, "Man, folks don't want to hang out, chase women. Won't be a no good." But it came through. For instance, none of the girls in my neighborhood could go to a dance unless I was going. The parents would check, "Preston, you going to be at the dance now?" And then when we, on the way home, I said, the girls would always, and the guys would say, "Listen, give me 15 minutes. I said, no. When I leave you, when your mother asks me what time, I'm said, I saw it left you at 12:02. 12:09, whatever time was, I couldn't light them. You know. And I'm sure that contributed to who I became, you know. Because I once went home and visited one of my friends. I knocked on the door. His mother is telling his son, "I want you to grow up and be like Preston Wolf." She came to the door and almost fainted because she didn't hit the door. And so, to me, that was a kind of responsibility. You know, and people look to me to provide that kind of responsibility. And also, I'm convinced that I was never in the on a journey to become a Negro. I mean, once when I was about second or third grade, I went to school and told the story about a little black Sambo, because my grandfather told me that at Friday night meetings, family meeting, and the teacher loved the story so much from a stereotypical standpoint. But I was telling the story from a standpoint that Sambo outthought the tiger, turned the tiger into butter. You remember that? And I'll never forget, he took me to every class upstairs. I'd never been on the second floor of my life. And he wanted the kid to hear the story. And he was enjoying the stereotype part of a little black Sambo, which, by the way, is an Asian story, not a South American story. And he never could acknowledge that my punchline was different than his punchline. And I always considered it as one of my first times taking him on, because I learned you can't take on white folks in distance. You got to take them on face to face, eye to eye, one half inch off their heads. Right. And a lot of our professionals reassure white folks that no matter what you do, I will never kick your ass. Mm-hmm. And say, I don't promise brothers and sisters. So I went to Morehouse, because my friend told me about Morehouse. And I consider that one year at Morehouse the major educational experience of my life.
Who were your classmates?
Hugh Lane, he was the main one, you know. Jerome Harris, basketball player. Oliver Brooks, a couple other people like that. Mm-hmm. Also, I used to hang out with the guys from Harlem at Clark. Rody Jacox, Joe Gibbs. And I'm not that I didn't like the Morehouse guys, but I started hanging out with them.
Was Benjamin Mays the president?
Dr. Mays was president. I'll never forget doing one of our blackouts in Yates and Milton drugstore. Mm-hmm. Somebody put a box of Kotex under my arm. The lights come on. I'm standing there with a box of Kotex under my arm. I still don't know to the day who put it under. Dr. Mays called me to his office. And it took me years to understand that, because see, there were gay men there, but for some reason or other, they never messed with me. But the guys I went to school with years later told me that even some of the teachers were gay and were working with the kids. And so I think he called me in to find out if I was gay. You know, and he was serious about it. I had a lot of respect for him, man. And they taught us something about going back serving your own people. Like, many of the graduates went to Liberia the moment they graduated. Like, the current thing's going on, you know. That's where Garvey went, you know. And that's where Du Bois went later to undermine Garvey. You remember with the airline, he sold the land to an airline, rubber. What's the rubber company?
Yeah.
Goodyear.
That's right.
He sold the land that Garvey was supposed to get to Goodyear, because every time I see a football game, Goodyear flies, I think about that.
Yeah.
Because Garvey never got to Africa, you know.
Yeah. And did you?
I have the article on that, by the way, too.
Did you? What did you major in?
Good question. So I wanted to be a doctor, and I majored in, sciences and so forth. I was only at Morehouse for one year because I went into the military. But I'm glad you asked me that, because a lot of people... I was an all-A student at Morehouse. Like, some of the guys, my friends who are doctors, now I remember. One of them just asked me about 2 months ago, "Why? What happened with you? You had all-A students." Well, my mother and father separated, and I figured I had to follow my mother to New York. She came here as a domestic, and I came here. I'd been in New York before to get prisoners, you know, but I never lived here. And I always say that probably one of the reasons I never became a doctor is that I didn't come from a professional family. Get my point?
Mm-hmm.
I felt, because I went down to Howard several times, talked with them, they wanted to let me in dental school. I said, no, I want to go to medical school. Because I'm, you know, and, but I maintained that, you know, I look at it, that so, that was the problem.
Okay, I'm just trying to get the sequence, the chronology.
Yeah, okay.
You were at Morehouse.
Yeah.
Then what? Then you went to the military.
I went to the military.
What branch?
Air Force.
Air Force.
Greensboro, North Carolina.
There weren't that many black people on the Air Force.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And my whole life, we were segregated. And I'm glad you're doing this, man, because while I was there, the government wiped out a pilot training program at Tuskegee. All black pilots training the 99th Air Squadron. And they sent them to my base in Greensboro, North Carolina. And the first day they were there, they asked me to take them down, do some KP. We got down there, they wanted to do KP for the prisoners of war. These guys are college graduates, pilot trainers. So it was nothing but embarrassment. And some of these guys were very upset. I had never met a group of educated black men of that caliber, you understand that? That many. Even though I went to Morehouse, you know, I didn't hang out with all the graduates. And so every day I would take them to sick leave, starting the second day. I said, you got a cold, you got a stomach. And by the time we left sick leave, they have to get the white boys to do the KP for the prisoner, which they should have done anyway. They were living on the
white... When you say prisoners of war, who are you talking about? Who?
Pardon?
Who? Germans?
Germans. Oh, yeah, this is World War II. You were German POWs, POWs. And they had, you know, captured them and stationed them there on a segregated base. They put them in the white area, but the white guys were not good enough to do KP for them. And my sergeant, Sergeant James, whose brother used to own La Famille on 125th Street, called me in and threatened to charge me with treason for not taking these black pilot trainers to do KP for German prisoners of war. And I said, okay, make a charge. You know, that's right. And I was a young guy, you know, 21, 22. And because I played on the Army military basketball team, and I had a lot of guys from New York on there.
So how long were you in the military?
From November 5th, 1943, to March 17th, 1946. And that's when I came to New York. And I played on a basketball team in the military. And I met, I'll never forget it, Mary McLeod Bethune and Eleanor Roosevelt on Bennett's College campus. And I shook hands with them one after another. I'll never forget it. And it was like meeting W.E. Du Bois in Atlanta.
Was that while you were a student?
He was teaching at AU when I was in Morehouse. That's when he went to, Hugh Lanning went to store for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Charlotte Hawkins Brown School was right near there.
Did you ever go to hear him in class?
Huh?
Did you ever see Du Bois in class?
Well, he used to take us to meetings and say, come on, and sit over there, you know. And we'd sit there, and he'd say, now write up what you experienced. And we were not a part of the meeting. But he was great at the door. He was your teacher, which is, to me, is a tremendous technique, you know. And no, he didn't expect you to understand everything, but he wanted your assessment of what you saw. But he's also teaching not to waste your mind. And I just want to add this, that when I got into archiving, I attributed it to W.E.B. Du Bois, because I read it, one year I read everything I thought he'd written, you know. And I remember once in Atlanta being in a barbershop with him. And in my judgment, he was not comfortable in a black barbershop.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I'm not criticizing, but yeah. He came from Framingham, Massachusetts. And I remember when I was teaching at Princeton, that the black athletes didn't like to go to a black barbershop in town. They'd rather go anywhere to a white one, because that was like Princeton thing. And so I always figured that there was stuff that Du Bois wrote that he wouldn't recognize if he walked into it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like these guys on, you know, college campuses, you know, they take theory, but they never sort of practice. So they walk into the practice and never, also most of them are not capable of learning from a practitioner what they should know in order to understand their theory.
So 46, you come back to New York.
Yeah.
Then what happened?
When I first came to New York, I lived in Brooklyn, and I worked for a welfare department.
But did you go back to school?
Oh yeah, I went to City College. Oh, I'm sorry. I went to City from September 1946 until January 1949. That's when I graduated from City with a BS in science, you know. And I didn't like City because it was the cheatingest institution in the world. Every time they passed out these green books, white boys started writing, black guys were reading the questions because they had advanced information. They were in the dean in various department offices and so forth. Plus, if I got the highest grade on a test, they just passed out the sort of papers up. If a white boy got the highest grade on a test, Robert Smith, come up and get your papers. And then reading my paper down on fifth or sixth of them. And I never liked it. And also, one dean had the gall to call us in the Frederick Douglass Society, of which I was president, and asked would we rewrite our Constitution to keep communists out of the organization. And first place, if we want to do it, we don't need his advice. And we don't need him to rewrite it. But I'll never forget, the guys who went along with him went a long way. Some of them became deputy mayors and all this kind of stuff, you know. And I walked out of the room, because I'm not going to sit there and listen to that kind of stuff. And
who did you, the Frederick Douglass Society.
Yeah.
Who did you have come to speak on campus?
On campus, yeah. That's still the name of the black group up there.
But I mean, who, what people, what leadership, or what thinkers, what writers do you remember having had some contact with? Because
yeah.
You were in college then. I'm just wondering who you were dealing with in New York.
Man, you're shaking my memory. You know, that's heavy.
Did you have Powell come up?
Well, Adam was around, you know. I'd have to,
Did you know Richard Moore?
Huh?
Richard Moore.
Oh, yeah. I knew Richard Moore.
Douglass Bookstore.
Yeah, that's right.
The second floor.
Yeah.
Where they had the, lecture hall on one side,
that's
and
right.
Bookstore on the other.
And, wow. So, you know, you got me trying to drag up these names, because I know I knew.
No, but that's okay. Let me ask you.
Sweeting, remember Sweeting? His wife was here recently. But I tell you, the guys I remember most in Harlem are the Garveyites.
Mm-hmm.
Man, they were, like one of them by the name of Columbus, gave me the actual program when Haile Selassie came here looking for support, and the program from the Abyssinia Church. Make sure I make a note. I'll send you a copy to the brothers. And and see, Garvey, by the way, was a part of my upbringing in Ohio. Because every time the Garveyites had a national meeting, they would stop off in Youngstown.
So why?
I still have not been able to find out why they always stopped. But I even talked to a guy who was 96 years of age one time out there. And he was so See, the thing I found, the Garveyites understood what they were into more than any group I know of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm talking about the Panthers, the NAACP, CORE. And the Garveyites were well informed about what Garvey had in mind for them. And they still are. You know, I can still go to them and... as a kid, I used to follow their parades. And I've been trying to think about it lately, because in those days, there was no hope that black folks were going to do a goddamn thing. Really. Because the white folks had everything tightened down, man.
And,
like, you know, people going looking for a job will go look in the window, see if they hiring any blacks. No blacks are sitting there. They keep walking. And women got the jobs, they were doing domestic. Like my mother once a year would have all of her family out to help serve this white family she worked for. And with my job, starting at the beginning of the dinner, to start putting stuff in the trunk. Food. Because we didn't want to walk out all at one time. We knew what was happening. They'd ask you, where are you going with all the food? And by the time the last person was served, the trunk was jammed. And the other thing, things like, if somebody sent back lettuce, we wipe her off and send them back out. Because it was a war relationship. These people were acting like they respect you, and they didn't respect you, you know. And we knew that. And,
okay, so you graduated...
So marching, anytime I went marching behind Garvey's band, my family never said a word. They wouldn't, because everybody knew the band was everybody. And everybody would be marching behind the band. It was like a rare opportunity to express something about your own culture and your history and so forth that didn't come regularly, you know, because white folks didn't come to your church and all this kind of stuff. They knew you because they lived on the same block, but they never wanted to think of you as a collective. You as individuals, you know. And if anything, they wanted to advance you to become one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, and I'm thankful for that, you know. And
so in 1949, you graduated from City.
Yeah.
Then what?
Well, I applied for, you know, medical school. I got into Howard Dental School. I got into Flower Fifth Avenue as an alternate. And I was reluctant, by the way, to leave my kids. I have, you know, four kids, and I had three then. And
when did you get married?
Huh?
When did you get married?
1950. And I was reluctant to leave them. And you know, there were people who referred me down to Howard and so forth, doctors and so forth. But I always felt there was something about middle class upbringing that turned those mothers off, you know, that's what I felt. Even though I was smart, I got all A's, you know. Yeah, I still tell me, why you got all A's when and see, my family was not into that kind of stuff, you know. And you know, that's just a guess, you know.
Sure.
And now I worked for the welfare department, organized with the United Public Workers, which is mainly communists, you know. In fact, I always want to record the first picket line I ever walked on was with the Scottsboro case in Youngstown, Ohio, 1931. And a judge from my hometown defended them, you know. And I grew up to write a letter to Wallace, the governor of Alabama, to have the last Scottsboro boy pardoned. I have a letter from him thanking me for it. He said something about running the long races, you know. And I told that story, you know, to one of my school kids. He ended up in a joint. He wrote back to me, thanking me for telling him about the Scottsboro case. And I thought about all the black teachers who wouldn't dare tell black students about Scott's Borough. You know, like they're afraid they might get, they might turn wild or something, you know. And, anyway,
okay, so,
and that,
now, so what, where did you do graduate work?
I worked, when I came out of the military, my first job was with the Veterans Administration, as some kind of clerk, you know. And then I got a job with the Welfare Department. And then, while I was with the Welfare Department, they asked me to run a center for senior citizens. And I loved that experience because my position was, how am I going to tell people twice my age what to do? So I organized the center so they could run it. The only thing I did was handle the writing, you know, keep the records. But they decided what the meals were and everything. I'll never forget that. And they, whenever I'd get involved in like some
was,
kind of...
Was that in Harlem?
That was in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
And in Siloam Presbyterian Church, Reverend Glamison, who led the school and integration movement, that was in Brooklyn. That's where I met Jitsu, Sonny Carson, all those guys. And
so this is in the 50s.
And Al Vann.
Is this the 50s?
That was in the 50s, yeah. I went back to graduate school in 1955, Columbia University School of Social Work. I graduated in 57, so that was in the 50s. And while I was running that center, I was paid by the Welfare Department. And the thing I remember is that the guy who was in charge of the whole program, citywide, white, was always trying to tell me something, you know. And I used to let these guys know the only persons I follow blindly are my mother and my father because I know they love me. Anybody else, I'm going to check it out. I may not do what you want to do. If I do it because I come to a conscious decision, that's the proper thing to do. And I try to teach that to people, but they don't, you know, they guys are jumping the wrong gun. And but the thing I remember about that experience, how proud the older people were when they read something about me and doing something in the community, protesting or something. I mean, they had a tremendous sense of pride, man. They'd go home and talk about it, you know? And because they wanted me to be a man, you know?
Yeah.
And the funny thing about it now, many of these centers now are run by young people who try to tell older people to, you know. Now, how are they going to tell a black woman about what to do in the kitchen? It's impossible. Black women cook better chicken than anybody. They should own Kentucky Fried. Right. Like, Blimpy's downstairs now, they're selling cornbread. I said, man, black women make the best cornbread in the world. And we have not organized that yet. You know, Sylvia is still here doing a fantastic business in the region. She hasn't changed her menu. The same as it was 30 years ago. Cornbread. People go there just for the cornbread.
So what happened when you graduated from Columbia?
Graduated from Columbia, I remember, 57. I took a job in East Harlem, and I consider it one of my best experiences because I worked with blacks and Puerto Ricans. Now they call them Latinos or Spanish, back in those days. In fact, they spelled Puerto Rico P-O-R-T-O. And I used to have, they used to fly from Puerto Rico for $90. And I used to, I had a stage wagon, so I'd go out to the airport, pick them up. And I learned after the first trip I'm going to take some blankets because they wouldn't have no jackets and so forth. And I was running an organization called the East Harlem Project. It was funded by a foundation. But we had staff in schools and in the housing projects. Hmm. So we had an East Harlem Parents Association and an East Harlem Tenants Association. And It was an to me, it was one of my best experiences. Because, we organized a credit union in the agency, Union Settlement, I suggest that the whole community become a part of it. Man, within no time, he had $5 million, you know. And the credit union is still going, you know. Because I always believe in sharing with the people, you know. And, but that was a tremendous experience culturally, because I worked with Puerto Ricans, worked with Italians, I'm trying to think of the guy who this country used to infiltrate Mussolini's army. He's a mafia dude. I'm losing memory. Anyway, I knew him. And the other thing, when the cops came around the Union Settlement to spy on the Italians, we said, "No, man, we ain't going over that shit. These are our neighbors, man. These are our community." And they looked out for us, you know what I mean? Like, I remember that the Italian women can only get out when I invite them to a meeting. Once a year, they go to the bar where the men were. They had a big party. So, man, they loved being on my committee because they could get out of the house. But these guys checked me out. You know, I'm with no bullshit. And I admired that, you know. And now the Puerto Ricans, they like to have their wives come out to get them after the meeting. This would be so macho that if they don't come, you don't come get me, I'll go get them. And I'll never forget, I'm running a meeting, Puerto Rican guy's chairperson. All the members are black women. So about 9 o'clock, he sends his wife out to get coffee. Man, these black women, is he out of his mind? Why come he doesn't go? I'll never forget that. And then, they didn't ever tell him what they were upset about. But when he said, "Mr. Jim, no, we're not ready to go yet." He said, "Can we just have some coffee?" "No, I don't like coffee. Coffee makes me sick." They were letting them know they didn't like what he was doing. And I had to tell them after the meeting, because I couldn't tell them during the meeting, that, and there's a cultural difference here. You know, you send your wife out. I don't know a brother sent his wife out, you know. So there was that kind of cultural thing. And
so you were in East Harlem for how long?
So about 1963, when I was invited to Columbia. And by the way, so I wrote a paper on neighborhood planning at Union Settlement, which I gave at a settlement conference. I always felt that was why I was invited to Columbia. Because I told them that they don't have a right to plan for us, that we have a right to involve ourselves in our own planning. In fact, I wrote the first men proposal. That was the anti-poverty proposal. And what I did was, I had something like, I divided the neighborhood into 10 areas, 10 smaller areas. And each area had about 90 jobs paid for by the poverty program. And each area had a role in governance of the whole thing. So I always believed in governance. I still believe in it. When they talk about that proposal in that community, they say, man, everybody got a piece of the action. Because so many people got jobs. So, and they began to control the community. And one of the things that happened, the Italian gang, the Eagles, came down on the Dragons, Puerto Rican gang. And who got locked up in jail? The Dragons. Why? Because all the judges were Italian, right? So the Italians, you know, they arrested them, but they got sent home until the case came up. So I used that to teach the Puerto Ricans the power of politics. So they began to organize politically. Yeah. And just as a sideline, I had a student at Columbia who was working with a gang in Wilmington, Delaware. And the gang was being harassed by the cop. He invited me down, and I later found he was inviting me down to make him legitimate with the black gang. Because they didn't trust him. They kept giving him You know, yeah. The moment I got there, I understood exactly. He never told me what it was, but when I got there, I realized what it was. And so I suggested that they organize politically. They elected their gang leader to the state legislature, Chesie Miller. In fact, I have a letter from Hubert Humphrey praising me for seeing the positive value of this kind of thing. And I used to work with Sonny Carson's group in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and they had that same positive attitude, that they had a right to have a voice in their own community. And most of the social workers who worked with the gang treated them though they were potential criminals and all this kind of stuff.
Who invited you to Columbia?
I was invited to teach in the CO department, community organization. And the dean at the time was Mitch Ginberg. He and I were good friends. He knew me before. But see, there was a guy by the name of Mullen, M-O-L-L-E-N, who ran the City Planning Commission. He didn't like my statement because I talked about our right to manage our own lives, you know, and to control our own community. And the director of Union Settlement wanted me to go down and meet with him. That's why I figured, you know. And I couldn't figure out why he wanted me to meet unless he wanted to run into Tom. Well, I'm no Tom. But I began to realize from that thing that that's where they wanted me, you know. And by the way, most blacks slip into that position, you know. And so I did meet with the guy,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't tell him. I just said, if he got any question about anything I said, he had no question. Shortly after, I got a letter where I'd come over and join Columbia. And then at Columbia, most of the black teachers avoided me. Mm-hmm. And they used to tell me, like, I'd have lunch with my students. So why don't you have lunch with the faculty? I said, no, I want to enjoy my lunch. Because these guys want to ask me questions like, what do I think of Adam Clayton Powell? He's the baddest dude ever came down the pike, man. They would have read the New York Times and got something critical on him. And there was a guy up at Harvard who was always writing negative stuff about Adam. And he took the position that because Adam looked like a white man, that's why we were voting him. But Adam was blacker than most black men. Not only that, remember the book on the mulattoes?
Which one? Sharshi McIntyre's book?
No, it's long before that.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, they only had about one page on Adam because the mulattoes didn't accept him because, you know, he was black first, man. And I'll have to dig up that book. But they had a big section on Du Bois and, you know.
How long were you at Columbia?
10 years. And I left Columbia, man. I'm so glad you're doing it. So I was asked to plan Medgar Evers College. And Al Vann and Jim Farmer, I were three blacks on the planning committee. And there were four whites. And I think, by the way, I considered it one of the best jobs I had. And I'll never forget, Sonny came by one day and said, man, I'm glad you're down here on the inside. Sonny Carson, I said, man, don't worry. If you want to get in, come on, I'll open the door. Right? And what I found is that blacks who would want to complain, they wanted you to complain for them. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to come in and make their own complaint. Mm-hmm. I said, man, that's bullshit. That's what the way to white man. I'll let you in, you tell them what you want to tell them. If I agree with you, I'll support you. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to run your, you know. Anyway, and during that time, working with Jim Farmer was a beautiful experience. And he told me the story about how Edgar Hoover had filmed Martin in a hotel on 42nd Street and Lexington Avenue. I forget the name of it. Hyatt Regency. And J. Edgar Hoover wanted to release the film to embarrass the Martin, expose him. But LBJ wouldn't let him do it. So Jim Farman went to Washington to look at the films with LBJ. And he said that while LBJ was looking at the film, he said, "Hey, boy, turn that back, man. Let me see that." Now, this other thing I'm going to share with you. Ben Cheney lives in New York. I'm on a committee with him. He discovered that LBJ and the state of Mississippi gave Goodman and Schwerner $1 million each to families. Nothing to the Cheneys. He went, Ben, who's down on 42nd Street, he's in the same office with Ramsey Clark. You know, that's sort of a guess, you know. And he went to the LBJ library in Texas and documented the gift. By the way, I can understand it, I mean, but hell, why don't they give it to the Cheneys also, you know, $1 million?
Sure.
And, but anyway, so I resigned from Columbia thinking I was going to be teaching at Medgar-Evers because I wanted to be in the black community, you know. My experience at Morehouse, my experience with Mary McLeod Bethune. In fact, I must tell you, the only touchdown I ever made in college football was against Bethune-Cookman in Florida, Daytona Beach. And by the way, that's where Jackie went to spend 2 months before he went into the majors to get himself together. That's the first park named after him, Daytona Beach. And that was a smart idea, going to a black campus and mm-hmm. getting your stuff together, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
so you resigned.
Pardon?
You resigned from Columbia.
I resigned from Columbia.
Getting ready to teach, but then that didn't work out?
Huh?
What happened?
Well, I just resigned, that's all. And, I mean, like, now that's like a, people introduce me as though that, you know, that's the biggest thing I did in my life. That a bitch. It bothers me, you know what I mean?
Well, you mentioned Princeton.
Huh?
You mentioned Princeton.
All right. At Princeton...
When did you go to Princeton?
I did the pilot study leading to the Upward Bound program. I had 40 students from the state of New Jersey and who were on campus for the summer. And most of them were like gang members. And one of the things I found out, which you'll never see in the report, if a guy messed up in class, they would visit him at night, tell him, "Cut that shit out, man. We want this program for other kids after we leave." I'll never forget that. And I could never share that with the white boys, because they always thought gangs were, you know, thugs, you know, mafia or something. So I never shared it with them. But every one of the kids who was visited showed significant improvement in the opinion of the teacher who did not know he was visited.
I mean, now, who visited him?
Pardon?
Who visited him? Who? Who went to make the visit?
Oh, the kids did.
So they, if one was messing up,
yeah,
then they would have a discussion that night.
They were still up in his room that night. Mm-hmm. And now they let me in on it, but they didn't let the faculty in on it. So they, you know, they knock on the guy's door. And tell him, "I don't cut that shit out, man, and get your work for it." And in fact, the only guy who didn't go to college was a gang member. Because he was so busy walking. Now, nobody was busy in his room, you know what I mean? And but 39 of them ended up in college. Hmm. And I visited all of their families in New Jersey, because I knew when the families came to Princeton University, they're going to be in a strange motherfucking place. So I wanted to know somebody. And one of the exciting things that happened, when they went to the barbershop, they didn't have Princeton stuff on like the black students did on campus. So the guy would not cut their hair. They went to the white barber, because that's where the guys on the campus were. And the black barber was miles away. So they met with the director of the program, a white guy, and said, "Listen, We want you sitting in the chair. They organize this, by the way. When we come into the barbershop on Saturday morning, so he was sitting there getting his hair cut. They walked in. The barber said, "Sorry, kids, I will not be able to serve you." This guy stood up for the first time in his life. He said, "Listen, if you don't cut these guys' hair, I'll close the shop down." I'll never forget that. And he was happy about having that opportunity in his life, you know. And but the black students, whom many of whom I knew, they were ducking that, you know. And they were not like, there was a white girl in the program. I walked in the library one day, they wouldn't let her use the library. She was a teacher in the program. I said, "Listen, she's a member of the faculty." I knew that all male shit. I remember I met another white student, told me he was the fastest track man in Florida. I said, "You ever hear of Bob Hayes?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, we don't run against black." The guy still calls himself the fastest man. And that's not, I mean, the illogic of it all. Anyway, that was the pilot program for the Upward Bound program. And later on...
You mean pilot for the country?
Yeah. Later on, they had a conference in New Orleans. We took over the conference on the basis that these programs were the high number of black students should have black leadership.
What year was that?
I don't know, but I had the report. I'll find it.
Approximately.
Oh, sorry. Well, Princeton was 1964.
Okay.
That was the year that Schwann and Cheney and Goodman got it, mm-hmm. on June 21st. And by the way, I want to mention this. The only good thing J. Edgar Hoover ever did, in my opinion, he sent a mafia dude into the jail in Mississippi to find out where the bodies were. And he slipped a gun into the guy, and the guy put the gun in a KKK's mouth,